Welcome to We've Got Issues. I'm Joshua Holland, and our guest this week is Rebecca Lieber. Rebecca is a first-rate reporter for Mother Jones, covering primarily the environment and climate change, although she does write about other issues as well. First, I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, alternate managing editor Liz Preza, to talk about a couple stories in what has been another tumultuous week in Donald Trump's America. Hi, Liz.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing well.
How are you in Trump-adjusted terms?
Oh, you know, hanging in there.
Yeah. So, big week. Nancy Pelosi, we're recording on Thursday, as we usually do. Nancy Pelosi directed the Judiciary Committee to start drawing up impeachment articles.
It's happening. It's all happening.
It's really happening. And, it's funny because I was watching the proceedings, and Republicans, their strategy, as usual, is just to obstruct everything and make everything drag out as long as possible. They were making all of these like silly amendments, and then they'd insist on a roll call. So then you'd have this like, Mr. Collins, nay, you know, that like, and I was wondering what they were trying to accomplish. And I realized they're just trying to make it boring. They don't want people watching, right? They want people to tune out.
Well, that was the whole thing is like, these impeachment hearings aren't sexy enough. So let's keep them unsexy.
Right. I mean, we talked about that when we were talking about Pizzazz Ghazi.
Yeah, the pizzazz Ghazi.
The lack of pizzazz. Jazz hands. Meanwhile, they need jazz hands.
I thought Pelosi had a lot of pizzazz today when she, I don't know if you caught this, but when she berated a reporter for asking her if she hates Donald Trump.
Yeah, that was nice.
Did you see that?
That guy, yeah, that guy is I think he's with One America News Network.
Yeah, yeah.
And she has in the past called him a walking trove of Republican talking points.
I thought it was great. Great smackdown on Nancy Pelosi's part. Yeah. I don't say often.
Yeah, you know, credit where it's due.
Yeah. You know, I thought Justin Amash, who, of course, is the former Tea Partier turned independent because he hates Donald Trump's impact on the Republican Party. I thought he had an interesting kind of critique of the Democrats' performance during impeachment hearings, because he made the point that they made a strategic error by not engaging more with the witness that the Republicans brought on, Jonathan Turley.
Yeah.
Saying that, you know, there were a lot of holes in his testimony that they could have gone after, and they kind of squashed that by just sticking to their own witnesses.
I think that there's some merit to that. I mean, Turley is such a hack. And by the way, he is an opinion contributor to The Hill, right? Which was distributing, Trumpian talking points on the Ukraine, which is just totally embedded in this entire scandal. And he writes regularly for them. One of the things that I thought, so Turley made a couple of points. He said, well, you know, this may not be a crime that could be prosecuted in a court of law, which is an odd argument, right? Because of course
it's
impeachment.
It's not necessary.
Yeah, it's impeachment. And one of the Democrats called him on that by quoting something he had written in the Wall Street Journal, stating flatly, obviously, you know, impeachment, you don't need a prosecutable crime for that. I thought that was kind of a weird debate also, because these are crimes. I mean, especially most obviously obstruction of justice is a felony.
Right.
So you know, okay, we are actually charging him with crimes. And then he also made the point that this was moving too fast.
Right. I'm so confused. Is it moving too fast? Is it moving too slow?
It's just something. One other thing about Turley, which is just kind of maddening, is he compared this to the Clinton impeachment, which, if you recall, was about lying about a blowjob. And and the funny thing is that he was very much in favor of the Clinton impeachment. This guy is one of those guys who's like, I'm a liberal, and I, for some reason, my views and arguments always align with the far right.
Yeah, they definitely could have gone after him. I agree with Justin Amash, which again, not a frequent, it,
you know, stopwatch, blind squirrel.
What else? We have some more news about Rudy Giuliani. Of course, you know, not a week goes by where Rudy Giuliani isn't doing something crazy.
I think George Soros is paying for him.
That's a good theory. But yeah, so investigators got Rudy Giuliani's phone records, and they revealed what ton of communication with, of all people, Devin Nunes. John Solomon makes another cameo.
John Solomon is in there. Pernas, right? It just seems like this is such a vast web. Like, there's just this vast criminal conspiracy to fabricate a investigation into the Bidens for 2020 and absolve Russia of any involvement in 2016. It's really, and to have Devin Nunes, who is like, you know, a chia pet up there, just like this little chirping chia pet, involved in this whole scheme. I mean, I guess it shouldn't come as much surprise, but it really is kind of eye-opening. And by the way, there was one of the reporters for, I believe, the Daily Beast said that they had, no, it was the Washington Post, so they had called Giuliani to, or maybe they called Devin Nunes' office to check a fact. And who called them back? John Solomon. Oh my God. So they're all, it's this fully integrated disinformation apparatus, right? You've got Rudy Giuliani running around. Yeah. You've got the right-wing media. They're all talking. Devin Nunes is in the house. He's doing his thing. And they're all talking back and forth. One of the more interesting phone records from Giuliani was multiple calls to the Office of Management and Budget. That is, of course, the office within the White House that sends out funds for, say, military aid to Ukraine. And, and remember, Giuliani is not part of the government. He is Donald Trump's personal attorney, as he often reminds people. And what is he doing calling OMB while they're strong-arming Ukraine into making a public announcement of these investigations? And then right now, as we speak, Giuliani is where? In Ukraine, right? Continuing the same thing. He talked this week with, I actually think he just got back from Ukraine, but this week he was in Ukraine. He talked to the former Ukrainian prosecutor, Yuri Lutsenko, and he talked to this fascist who has been an integral part of this whole campaign. It's just amazing. And what it suggests is that, like, there's so much impunity. They just feel like they can get away with anything. They no longer worry about, you know, like how it appears to the public. It's, you know, they have a base motivation strategy, and they just seem like, okay, we'll just keep doing this. And this gets back to Jonathan Turley's argument, I think, when he's like, they're moving too fast. There was a point that I think it was Schiff who made this. Schiff said, look, we're moving too fast, but they continue to commit the same crime.
Right. It's ongoing.
So, I mean, and that's always been the argument for impeachment, is that, you know, impunity always breeds more lawlessness. And, we're seeing it.
Right.
We're seeing it play out.
And just to put a little bow on all this, I mean, you mentioned before the apparatus, you know, Giuliani, who, remember, was in talks with The Hill to make an impeachment podcast, is apparently one of the reasons he's in Ukraine is for a documentary series he's doing with One America News Network on impeachment. So it really is just this entire apparatus that is trying to create this, you know, alternate reality. It's insane.
There's a lot of connective tissue between our different stories today, right? We started with with Nancy Pelosi, like, blasting the One America News Network correspondent, and here we are with Rudy running around trying to make a One America News Network documentary. It's just crazy.
Speaking of, you know, and Mitt Romney and Lindsey Graham literally made news yesterday by saying that there's no merit to the Ukraine scandal. So it's, it, or to, yeah, to the Ukraine Biden CrowdStrike. I don't know.
The conspiracy theories. Yeah. Well, the conspiracy theory.
There it is. Yeah.
Specifically, they rejected that Ukraine meddled in the 2016.
Meddled in the 20s. Yes, that's the one it was. So many conspiracy theories all the time. But I mean, that's the one it was.
It's telling. And go ahead.
Just they're making news for literally like accepting reality. It's totally, we totally live in an upside down world.
Yeah, we do. We live in an upside down world. Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess, you know, it's a reflection of the Alex Jonification of the Republican Party, that it's newsworthy when there are Republicans who are like, eh, that's a whack job conspiracy theory. And you know what? They're not entirely wrong. It is kind of newsworthy at this point.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
In other news, I wanted to bring a story to our listeners' attention. It was from The Guardian this week. The Guardian wrote that there is this Israeli-based group, a mysterious Israeli-based group that is using, I'll quote, 21 Facebook pages to churn out more than 1,000 coordinated fake news posts per week to more than 1 million followers around the world. And they are trafficking specifically Ilhan Omar of Minnesota and Rashida Tlaib of Michigan, the two Muslim women. First Muslim women to serve in the U.S. Congress, and they are using this operation, a vast international operation that exploits far right pages on Facebook to inflame Islamophobia. Jeez. For profit.
Jeez,
you know, it's crazy. It's crazy, and the extent of this operation is really it's eye opening.
Yeah, and it definitely, you know, amplifies Facebook's role in this once again, and just allowing this dissemination of false
information. News. Yeah, it does. And I think that, you know, I also was frustrated by, you know, sensible mainstream liberals jumping on some of those claims that Omar and Tlaib were anti-Semitic. They have to be aware of what kind of campaign they're supporting, if not directly, at least indirectly, because this is a really, really ugly campaign to demonize not just these two congresswomen, but 1.3 billion Muslims around the world. It is
dangerous.
It is. And I'd suggest that listeners check it out. It's the headline. Again, this is at theguardian.com. The headline is Revealed: Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib targeted in far right fake news operation.
Oh, aye. Well, in other news, we have a moment of levity, I would think. We have Baron Ghazi. It's Ghazi, right?
Yeah, that's right. Right. Gate. A real scandal is a gate, fake scandal is a Ghazi.
Yeah, so Melania Trump coming out and bashing, I guess is the word I would use, one of the Democrats' impeachment witnesses for bringing up Barron Trump during her
this
testimony.
This is so, so crazy. I mean, and here's the thing, and I hope that people understand. So there was nothing there. There was nothing there. Let me actually find the actual quote, just so people understand how silly this is.
She said that he can name his kid Baron, but he cannot make him a Baron.
That's right. And right. She was directly asked, can you speak to the differences between a king and a president? And she said, well, you know, you can just what you said. He can name his son Baron.
Yeah.
He cannot name him a Baron. That is not uncivil. That is not a swipe at Baron Trump in any way, shape, or form. It's just bizarre. It's just so bizarre. So on Twitter, Jonathan Allen, the NBC Washington, D.C. correspondent, he tweeted, there was a time when no one would think to invoke the minor child of a president in a derisive manner to make a political point at a congressional hearing.
The pearl clutching is so outrageous.
It's crazy. It's so crazy. And you know, like, I'm old enough to remember when Rush Limbaugh called Chelsea Clinton the White House dog when she was like 12 years old. And this idea that somehow saying, you know, the president can name his son Baron, but he can't make him a Baron, is an insult. It's just like, what are we talking about? Like,
no, I watched Outnumbered on Fox earlier today, and everybody on that couch was talking about how at the bare minimum, you're making fun of his name, his given name. I'm like, okay, yeah, but Trump gave him that name because it's the name that he used to use when he called to reporters and pretended to be his own publicist.
Liz, let's be clear. That is the name that he used to use when he called tabloid reporters to tell them what hot ladies he was banging. let's not forget what we're talking about here. One last note. The U.S. Treasury Department has announced sanctions today against a Russia-based cyber criminal organization. It is called Evil Corp. Remember that Rudy Giuliani and that bunch, they were working, their company was called Fraud Guarantee. So Fraud Guarantee, yes. And now we have Evil Corp. I got to tell you, the writers Evil of this show Corp. just suck. Too damn obvious. Anyway, on that note, let's move on. Let's take a quick break, and then we'll be right back with Rebecca Lieber. Stay tuned. Welcome back. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm really happy to welcome Rebecca Lieber to the show. Rebecca is an excellent journalist, really good, focusing mostly on environmental issues at Mother Jones, not exclusively, but mostly. Rebecca, welcome to We've Got Issues.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
Thanks for taking the time. I wanted to have Rebecca on to talk about a piece she recently wrote. It was titled Climate Change is Finally Having a Political Moment. That's no accident. This is kind of consistent with last week's show. I'm trying to find stories that are somewhat hopeful, not only for you listeners at home, but for me. It's so easy to be demoralized these days. So I'm looking for like rays of hope. And I hope people do check out the piece at motherjones.com. So Rebecca, this is a profile of the Sunrise Movement. I love these kids getting fired up and pressuring us geezers to take action on climate. I do have some questions that I'd like to get your take on. Before we do that, I got the sense from your piece that you came away thinking pretty highly of Varshini Prakash, the 20-something executive director of Sunrise. Can you just give us your impressions of her?
Yeah, so to back up a little bit about the piece, I happened to be on vacation a year ago when Sunrise really just burst onto the scene with this protest that AOC came by for. And I think no one knew about, I guess, Sunrise, the group at the time, or the general population didn't. But quickly, it was apparent that this was a group of incredibly charismatic young people who knew how to talk about climate change in a way that gets people's attention. And that was what I wanted to get the root of for this story. So for Varshini, I've watched her give speeches in a bunch of different contexts, usually at some political rallies that Sunrise has hosted. But one that really stood out was when I saw her speak to a room full of activists in Philly. And this was a day that was, I think it went maybe 7 or 8 hours of speech after speech about climate change, which it was draining after a while. I think the energy of the room seemed low. And then she came onto the stage. She just brings a lot of energy when she delivers these speeches, when she talks about what Sunrise is trying to do. And one thing she did immediately was lead the room in a song, actually, which is a big thing that I get into in the story. It's called song culture for groups that like Sunrise. So she just captivated this crowd of people on a subject that, you know, can get dry, climate, when talking about climate policy and future dates and target emissions. And I think that a lot of that speaks to her and her personality and her experience as an organizer. But I think it's really symbolic for how Sunrise really gets in your face and gets people's attention.
You know, I recall I was driving in my car last week and I heard the tail end of this NPR interview with a historian of mass movements. I didn't catch her name, unfortunately, but she was talking about the necessary elements for successful mass movements. And she listed a bunch of them. And one of them was charismatic leaders that are able to speak to people and really move people on an interpersonal basis. Sunrise is relying on a relatively new organizing strategy that you talk about in the piece. It's called Momentum. What is that, and how I guess how does it differ from more traditional models?
Yeah, so that was basically the secret I discovered in the story of what's behind Sunrise. And Momentum is probably best defined as an approach to organizing. They're basically pulling from a ton of different movements and theories about from civil rights to Occupy Wall Street to the Arab Spring. And basically, Momentum pulls what they think, what the most effective strategies have been, and it tells organizers how to grow a movement, how to sustain a movement. And I think when we talk about advocacy on the left, it often sounds like this magical thing that just happens, that spontaneous protest. And we've seen that in the Trump era, that you things like the Women's March, which kind of occur as this more spontaneous digital first tactic. But there's a ton of legwork that goes behind this and infrastructure building for the most successful protests and movements. And that's what Sunrise is trying to do here. They are, at the same time that they're staging events and rallies and protests, they're also trying to build out a infrastructure that can plan and be more effective the next time. So they've done this through these trainings with their younger leaders of getting everyone on message about the climate crisis. They've and Varshini, she walked me through in a few of these cases, like the sit-in with Nancy Pelosi's office, how they really capitalized on that moment so they would drive it back to building their membership, really engaging young people in the fight against climate change, so people don't just wash their hands of it and go home and think they achieved something. So Momentum teaches a few different strategies for how to do that. There's an actual training institute called Momentum Community that trained leaders, the leaders of Sunrise and Black Lives Matter and immigrant rights groups in these strategies. And one of the tactics that I mentioned earlier in this interview, song culture, that comes out of Momentum. Something basically tactics that engage people that tell you how to build your own narrative as an organization and a strategy here. So it for the story, the challenge was everything got pretty theoretical very fast, especially when you're talking to lots of people who are not too far off removed from college and grad school.
Right.
But it really got fascinating to get into the DNA of a movement.
And you know, it's impossible not to be impressed by how, I mean, you mentioned them just kind of like appearing on the scene, how much, sorry for using the word momentum again, but how much momentum they seem to have gained in such a short time. And really, these are impressive organizers just in that they're in our heads, you know, after a relatively short period of time on the scene. So you write that they decided to focus on motivating youth. And you, let me quote you, say, young people have a good track record of challenging the status quo, but more importantly, the threat of climate change feels particularly acute to young people. Without immediate action, the environment will profoundly change in their lifetimes. It strikes me that there is a double-edged sword here in that young people, because they have so much more to lose, they have a very powerful moral argument. They also have lots of energy. Their knees don't make noise when they get out of bed in the morning. Mine do. My knees snap and they crackle and they pop. But at the same time, it seems like it is easy for climate change deniers and other you know, enemies of progress to dismiss young people as naive or ill-informed or claim that they're being manipulated by older people. I don't really have a question here. Or maybe my question would be whether you've encountered more veteran activists who worry about this or are hostile to it, or your thoughts on this.
Well, I think there's been skepticism of some of the ideas here, like Green New Deal, what it stands for, and whether that is the best strategy. And I think that is certainly a debate within climate circles, as well as I think throughout the country. But I guess for, you know, what I find, and I think just people who've been in this fight, and either whether it's covering climate change or as on the activist side fighting this, it's a breath of fresh air, and that's been a lot of the response. I think you see this with Greta Thunberg's rise to stardom, that people are relieved to see young people standing up for and becoming the spokespeople for climate, because like you said, they're naturally a better better storytellers for this, having that they're going to face the impacts in their lifetimes. In a different story, I talked about how we now have an actual climate change generation, that the people who are most impacted are now, they're getting old enough, they are starting to turn into voters to speak up. And I think that with school strikes, we've seen this in protests, I think that really helps to change the conversation. I think there has been a lot of skepticism surrounding this. And of course, there's been a few stories looking at also just the harassment that accompanies any one online these days, that Greta in particular has now faced.
Yeah.
And again, at the end of the day, we're talking about, sometimes we're talking about teenagers.
Yeah, it's terrible. And you see that with the guns rights movement, with the gun safety movement as well.
Yeah,
these
certainly.
Kids just getting pilloried. It's terrible.
Yeah, it's not unique for climate, but I think the sea change in the broader movement here is really, I think, at least been exciting for a lot of people who just maybe have grown more cynical over the years, and also frightened that time is running short to actually contain this.
Yeah. I mean, related to that, and I don't want to be a wet blanket at all. And I'm so impressed by these young people, and they are inspiring. I also worry about this message that the impacts are going to be felt in their lifetimes, because the impacts are already being felt in our lifetimes. You know, I'm middle-aged and I'm experiencing the impacts, and I will experience more of them, you know, in my lifetime. So that's, I guess, just an aside. But I want to go back to something that you just mentioned, the kind of debate over the Green New Deal. It gets to this, you know, talking about the political challenges of collective action sufficient to tackling the climate crisis. I mean, if you hold those in mind, then there's this criticism of the Green New Deal that it's overly expansive in its ambitions. Like you hear, okay, it's hard enough to tackle the climate without trying to, you know, restore the labor movement and tackle inequality. I think it's super important to make the argument. It's a valid argument that climate action will produce economic benefits. And I think it's super important to argue, as I did in The Nation about a month ago, that the cost of inaction way outweighs the cost of action. But I do see some validity to that argument that you're taking on too much, especially when you get to the nitty gritty of legislation. Like you're going to have a bill that says, okay, we're going to do all of these investments in clean energy, and we're also going to do all of these other things to kind of restore the American dream. I what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough issue. I think there's so many. I've struggled with this for so long. At the end of the day, we don't have a federal answer for climate, something that has been proven to pass through Congress that has withstood the courts. And I think what the Green New Deal conversation has changed, and I'm saying this without endorsing the Green New Deal, because I think a lot of the criticisms you bring up are valid here, but I think what it does is it links climate to other issues that the left in particular care about. I think it has broadened the conversation around climate. It's broadened the constituencies and the conversation of how you talk about it, that it's this at the core is an issue about inequality. And I think the Green New Deal, it's given the left something to rally around, because I think when we talk about climate change, a very easy criticism that the right has sometimes used is, well, you don't really have any answers how to fix this. And the Green New Deal, which links things like labor and racial justice and inequality to climate change, it can bring, I think that's a bit major reason why we've seen climate really skyrocket in polls, that it's much more in the conversation. It's not seen as this niche environmental issue, but a issue that affects us in so many ways. So I guess I don't like to play pundit of what I think will happen in the future with this conversation. I think it's just as likely, let's say Democrats did win in 2020, that instead of seeing an ambitious package of legislation move forward, you actually might see this, you would see this broken up. You might see a lot of these ideas done in a less ambitious way through executive action. I think it's not clear where this road will lead, but I think it's done a lot to change the narrative around climate.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And one way that I think it's changed the narrative is that, one of the valuable contributions of this kind of aspirational idea is that I think it really speaks to the scope of action that we need. And it says, look, I mean, even comparing it to the original New Deal, earlier, just maybe a decade ago, it was the Green Apollo Project. Everybody would talk about the Apollo Project. I think it is important to, you know, state very clearly that we need massive intervention in the economy, something on par with, a mobilization for war or a mobilization to get humans to the surface of the moon, something like that. So I think that it is very valuable in that. Let me shift a little bit here. You write in the piece, and I quote, Sunrise's leaders decided to focus on pushing Democrats on climate policy. Trying to convince Republican lawmakers to accept the science seemed like a poor use of precious time and resources. I would like to just juxtapose that sentence with a tweet by David Roberts, who covers climate, among other things, at Vox. I think, were you guys colleagues at Grist?
No, we didn't overlap, but I'm
didn't overlap. I know, okay. Dave. both veterans of Grist who have gone on to other publications. So he tweeted the other day, and again, I quote, "The U.S. is paralyzed on climate because of unified GOP opposition. It is bizarre to me, deeply, enduringly, endlessly bizarre, that this simple fact is virtually never stated clearly, not by Republicans, not by Democrats, not by the media. I feel like I'm in a weird effing dream sometimes." So every time Sunrise shows up at, say, Nancy Pelosi's office or Dianne Feinstein's office, someone on Twitter asks why they aren't camped outside of Mitch McConnell's office. And I can totally see why people would conclude that Republicans are, at this point in time, a lost cause and not worth wasting their time on. But what about how that might muddy the waters in terms of, you know, right now polls show that people really do want to see climate action, even if they don't want to pay for it, which is another story. Does this strategy kind of help obscure the point that David Roberts was making and ultimately take some heat off of the GOP?
Right. I think polling is really useful for thinking about this because I guess it's what audience you're thinking of, who is Sunrise trying to target. And one reason this is important is, so Republicans, and so there's a difference between the leadership of the Republican Party and the electorate, but polls have shown increasingly polarized, basically increasing polarization around climate, and that Trump has actually heightened that. The recent polls I've looked at, it actually shows Republican acceptance of the science has shrunk, and Democratic concern about climate has skyrocketed. And I think Trump has probably a big reason why. So if Sunrise were to stage the protests for Republicans and really target that, I guess the question is, who are they trying to reach then? I think the idea of the undecided voter, the moderate that Democrats and Republicans vie for in the 2020 election, there's increasingly this myth around that. But also, would a climate activist organization really also convince anyone of that this is, I guess, not to support a Republican? So I'm using that just as an example that the polarization on this issue is really key.
Yeah.
And the reason, I think, by targeting Democrats, they've managed to elevate this issue within the party that does already care. So politicians like Nancy Pelosi, who has long had an interest in climate, has sponsored legislation on climate. You can't call her a climate change skeptic at all. But I guess by targeting these high profile Dems, they've moved climate from what might have been a back burner issue to front of the pack. If Democrats won, that they now are on record saying that this is the top priority or one of them that they will move forward with. So I guess that's the explanation for why they're doing this. And if you're looking at this in the poll sense, I think for media though, there is certainly a responsibility to put all this in context that President Trump rejects the science, that this is not, not basically making this an issue of false equivalence, which journalists have dabbled with before. Their climate has long been an issue that in trying to talk about the two parties on the climate science, it's important for journalists not to present this as equal footing. So I think there's two sides of this, of the political strategy and how we talk about climate in politics.
Yeah, I hear you. It's a lot of these things are, you know, I'm not trying to criticize so much as there are complexities here. And there's areas where you think, okay, on the one hand, I see this point. On the other hand, you know, maybe this does, it does kind of muddy the waters a little bit. I hate the the phrase climate skeptic, because I don't think they're skeptics. You know, I think that the climate skeptics are like climate scientists who don't, you know, who use the scientific method and insist that everything be proven and that findings be confirmed by peers and different methodologies, et cetera, et cetera. These are denialists. Anyway, before I let you go, can you tell us a little bit about what we might expect from Sunrise, like in 2020 and then beyond?
So they're trying to build. Their base. Basically, they told me for this story that they aim to hold the biggest youth march in U.S. history by 2021, and we've seen that growing with these school strikes has been inspired by Greta Thunberg. But I think you're going to see them very involved in the election cycle. They've had some interesting developments in Kentucky, where they actually have a pretty active group over there, which is not a state you would quite expect, but there is, of course, Mitch McConnell's race there. So I think that's an interesting development to watch right now. So just today, Sunrise released their first scorecards for the presidential race and the Democratic primary on their climate actions. And they might be, I think they're still debating endorsements, but that's something that they are gearing up to start rolling out endorsements for their favored climate candidates. So I think you're going to just see them increasingly active, kind of using these some of these more aggressive tactics than we see some of the longer term climate groups that have been around. Just Sunrise using these in your face tactics that really dominate the news cycle. I think, well, that's just going to ramp up like everything else does until the election. But then they want to hit the ground running if a Democrat wins with moving forward on some iteration of a Green New Deal and moving forward with mobilizing a base that would demand action like that. So we're just going to see things heat up.
Yeah. I'm on record thinking that I'm concerned that Democratic base voters have identified healthcare as their top policy priority. And contrary to common belief, you know, politicians actually do try to fulfill their campaign promises. I'm a little bit worried that it's entirely possible that they only get one bite at a big legislative effort if they do very well and win the Senate as well as the White House. And I would hope that climate and democracy would come before healthcare. That's just my personal view. Rebecca Lieber, I believe we're out of time. I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me today.
Yeah, thanks. It was great.
I'd also like to thank Liz Preza and David Edwards, our producer and engineer. I'd like to thank the good people at Alternet and Ross Story for supporting the show. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. Please do. Please do. I'd appreciate it. And you can subscribe to the show. I'd like to say wherever you can get your podcasts, we're working on that. But you can certainly subscribe to the show at many, at an ever-increasing number of podcast hosting services. Of course, I would like to thank all of you fine people for tuning in. Have a terrific week.